This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop.
This is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of December 2019. Thank you for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5, the NPR station in Austin, Texas. Here's what we got for you this week. Religious groups step in to provide contraception as Planned Parenthood gets sidelined in Texas.
We'll ask you if we can pray for you, and if you say yes, then we will, and if you say no, then we won't.
How does Austin School District move forward after its equity officer called the school closure plan racist?
That is an admission that what we're doing is not working, and that is the absolute first step in changing the culture.
And who started the tradition of residents putting up an extreme amount of Christmas lights on that stretch of 37th Street?
We connected over someone's house who had no lights. That was sort of the big catalyst for people to, I want to put up lights. I want to do this.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. Ah, yes, it is that time of the year again. And because of that, I just wanted to let you know there will be no KUT Weekend next week. We're taking the week off for the holidays. But we'll be back the week after that, and I hope you will join us for all the news that we will be learning about together in 2020 here on KUT Weekend. The Austin area housing market is on track to have a record-breaking year in both the number of homes sold and how much they sold for on average. And barring some unforeseen event, local housing is expected to become even less affordable in 2020.
This is Dr. Jim Gaines. I'm the chief economist at the Real Estate Center at Texas A&M University.
I like to call this guy up sometimes to talk about the housing market. He's one of the few economists with full access to the MLS in Texas, the multiple listing service that realtors use. And he helps groups like the Austin Board of Realtors put out their reports. This week, we got a major report from ABOR, the Austin Board of Realtors, saying the five-county metro area saw more than 30,000 home sales through the end of November. That's the first 11 months of the year. And so now we're just about 300 shy of breaking the all-time record for the number of homes sold in the Austin area. So I asked Jim Gaines what he saw in the data when he parsed it.
The real key here, the number you just referred to, over 30,000 sales year to date through November is up 6%. That is a meaningful number, that year to date number. We're going to end the year in Austin with, again, for several years in a row, we've set a new record every year for the total number of sales. 2019 will be another record year. It'll be up somewhere around the 5.5 to 6% mark. You know, you couldn't ask for anything more. Like a lot of markets, though, one of the problems is that we still have such a low inventory of properties being offered for sale, which incidentally is the dichotomy in the market. How can we be setting such records, such good records, and having such percentage increase in sales with such low inventory?
Inventory, the number of homes available to buy, is measured by economists like Jim Gaines in months, as in the Austin metro area has about 2 months supply right now. And that means all things being equal, we would sell out in about 2 months. For just the Austin city limits, the inventory in November was 1.3 months. So I asked Jim, how are we seeing so many home sales with such low inventory?
Well, it's because the homes that do come up for sale aren't staying for sale very long. The days on market of exposure and the marketing process are short. The realtors and the other agents that are selling the properties are working with buyers and are looking for properties. And as soon as they become available or a property becomes available for sale, they're being bought. It's almost like in the manufacturing sector, kind of referring to just-in-time inventory. That's the way the pace of these sales have been going. I can tell you, for example, the rate of increase in new home sales that have gone through the MLS, at least, has been considerably better. It's up over 10% year-to-date and up over 20% November over November.
But yet inventory in the city of Austin is just 1.3 months. And you've said in the past a stable market is a 6-month supply.
In Austin, I would call it 5. I've done the historical analysis in Austin. It's 5, but nevertheless, it's a whole lot more than one. There again, we're setting records. We're selling the houses, like I say, almost as fast as we can list them.
How is that even possible? How are people snapping them up so quickly?
Again, because in the marketing process, think of it this way, the agents are dealing with buyers all the time, and they know what they're looking for, they know where they're looking for, they know what they're willing to pay. So as soon as a listing becomes available or they get the listing, they're calling the buyer in many cases even before they can fill out the paperwork. But you do need to be dealing with someone who's keeping their ear to the market, you know, keeping their eyes open and knows what's going on in a timely fashion.
So what do you recommend to people, especially those first-time home buyers who don't have a bunch of home equity built up yet? They don't have a lot of money for a down payment. Do they drive till they qualify? Do they buy something small like a condo, or do they just continue to rent?
You're exactly correct on all of those statements. Drive until you can buy is true. I mean, don't forget the data that we're talking about here is for the multi-county metropolitan area. We're talking about over in the Bastrop County. We're talking about down in Hayes County, going up into Williamson County. Most people tend to focus like inside the city limits and so forth. Well, that's a whole different world.
And it is much smaller compared to the region as a whole.
Precisely. So, and the home builders, the reason new home sales are up as much as they are and doing as strong is because the home builders have gone further out. They've acquired a little bit less expensive land, and they are building homes as much as they possibly can into the pricing sweet spot, if you will, of where the mass market is looking to buy. At the lower end, the first entry-level market, and then maybe the first buy-up market, the first upgrade. So those two markets are doing well. One of the reasons there's a shortage of inventory is, of course, people my age, and I'm a baby boomer, are living in our houses longer. We're simply aging in place is the phrase that's being used so much, but we are. We're not moving. We're not leaving. Hell, we just refinanced our properties for less than 4% interest rates, so why do I want to give that up? And then I also am faced, if I wanted to move, I'm faced with that shortage and the high price. I can't find something I want to move to. I got the same problem as an entry buyer. I may be at a different price point, a higher price point. I'm simply hanging on to my property longer than historically. People tended to turn their houses over every 5 to 7 years, and that's now turned into, more like 9 to 12 years.
Well, given that, from a strictly financial perspective, Jim, does it still make sense to try to save up a down payment and buy a home?
Oh, yeah. It is still far and away the best way of building wealth. Right now, interest rates are low. Lending is relatively easy, not just the cost of the borrowing, but just the qualifications to qualify for the loan, the amount of down payment and so forth is appealing if you can do it. If you can find the product, if you can find the house that you're looking for, there is no reason to expect it to be better or easier anytime in the next year or two. And in the meantime, owning the property and building household wealth is still a very positive kind of thing. You're going to have trade-offs, though, and you just said it. We've alluded to it now twice. To find the house that's affordable, you're probably going to be further out if you work downtown or in one of the major employment centers, and you're going to swap commuting for home price.
And I know the Texas A&M Real Estate Center put out that housing forecast this week, Jim. Tell me, what do you all predict for the Austin area housing market in 2020?
Yeah, Austin is going to continue to grow. The housing market's going to continue to be very, very solid in the sense of the sales and the prices. It's going to continue to be tight. Now, whether it'll stay at less than 2 months, but it's going to be less than three and a half months, which is still tight. Of course, now Austin is beginning to, I think the residents of Austin are beginning to kind of figure out, hey, it's getting kind of crowded. We've got transportation issues. We've got some public infrastructure issues. We've got schools and education issues that have to be dealt with, especially where you have new development. You got to build new schools and so forth. These are basically growing pains. Just like a human being goes through growing pains and towns and communities and metropolitan areas are the same thing. I know that all of the old timers around Austin remember it when it was, half a million people some years ago. But Austin is growing toward being a community of, 3 million, 4 million, 5 million in the next few decades. We need to have far enough sight into that future to start preparing for that and not get caught by surprise.
Jim Gaines, Chief Economist at the Texas A&M Real Estate Center. Thank you, Jim.
No problem. Enjoyed it.
When Texas lawmakers forced Planned Parenthood out of its health program for low-income women, the state struggled to find healthcare providers that could fill that service gap. That led to the rise of crisis pregnancy centers, which are Christian centers that support women in their pregnancy and also dissuade them from getting abortions. But some of those centers are changing their tactics in Texas. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports one chain of CPCs plans on offering contraception to women in an effort to prevent unwanted pregnancies in the first place.
One of these clinics is here in Austin, north of 183, right off of I-35. It's a one-story building in a mostly residential area. It's surrounded by trees and has a gravel path out front. Inside, there are modern and bright furnishings, and not really anything that signals this is a Christian organization. No crosses, no religious artwork. Andy Schoonover, the CEO of this chain of clinics called The Source, says this is intentional.
So we are a faith-based organization, but we don't push our faith down anybody's throat. We'll ask you if we can pray for you. And if you say yes, then we will. And if you say no, then we won't.
Schoonover's vision is creating a chain of religious women's health clinics. These clinics used to be crisis pregnancy centers, which have been pretty controversial. For one, these centers have been known to present themselves as healthcare clinics for women who are pregnant, but instead don't provide any real medical care. Schoonover shows me around the Source's clinic in Austin. He says this clinic was built to provide actual healthcare.
Our nurse manager is here. So again, we're doing full medical, everything from STI, STD testing, well woman care. So you have your annual checkups. You can get contraception here.
The state of Texas has increasingly been relying on religious groups and new providers to deliver family planning services in the state after kicking longtime providers like Planned Parenthood out of their program. And women's health advocates say this shift hasn't been going well. For example, one Christian anti-abortion company called the Heidi Group was part of the state's family planning program, but state officials found they weren't providing the services they were contracted to provide. So Texas health officials kicked them out of the program and forced Heidi Group to repay $1.5 million. Cami Joffrey, the CEO of the Women's Health and Family Planning Association of Texas, says untested providers shouldn't be used in these kind of programs in the first place.
If we are funding unqualified healthcare providers in Texas, we are taking money away from qualified comprehensive healthcare providers.
But state and federal officials have been forcing longtime providers like Planned Parenthood out of family planning programs. This has left a huge need in a state like Texas, which was already struggling to provide contraception and screening services to low-income women. Schoonover says he thinks a group like his can actually fill that need, though.
We do substantially everything that Planned Parenthood does. The only thing we don't do is abortion, right? And you can go on Google and figure out where to do that.
There is another way in which The Source is not like Planned Parenthood, though. The clinics don't plan on offering the full spectrum of contraception. Specifically, they don't plan on offering IUDs, which are the most effective method of birth control. Schoonover says this decision is based on his religious belief that IUDs harm human life by not allowing a fertilized egg to attach to the uterus.
As a faith-based organization, I believe that sperm and egg come together, it's a new human life, and so we want to protect that life. And so IUDs is not something that we'll do, but pretty much everything else we will do.
This is a common belief, by the way, among anti-abortion organizations. But Cami Joffrey says it's an example of why she has concerns about groups like this providing health care.
It's important that providers leave their bias at the exam room door and that clients work together with providers to leave that exam room with everything they need in that visit.
She says that's because in many instances, this is the only time many of these women will see a medical provider that year.
And if they leave without the contraceptive care that they need and want, they may experience an unintended pregnancy because they were not seen and heard by the provider that day.
Joffrey's biggest concern is that groups like The Source will eventually start getting federal funding that could be going to more established and comprehensive clinics. And for now, Andy Schoonover says The Source is mostly funded by private donations. He plans on opening another 20 faith-based clinics in the next few years. Women will pay on a sliding scale or nothing at all, depending on their financial situation. And they will offer contraception, which, by the way, has earned Schoonover pushback from the religious community as well.
Yeah, there's a stigma there within the faith community about contraception. We take a much more pragmatic approach on it, which is, hey, listen, you have two opportunities here. You can send them away without any contraception. They'll probably get pregnant again. They'll probably have an abortion. Is that a good thing, right? Or can we send them away with contraception and they are more than likely not going to get pregnant?
Schoonover says, regardless of where the pushback is coming from, he says he's going to continue to do this work because he thinks it's the right thing to do. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
Austin's downtown diversion court says rates of recidivism among repeat offenders, many of whom are homeless, dropped by huge margins last year. As KUT's Andrew Weber reports, the court attributes the results of the analysis to an increased focus on homelessness in Austin.
The Downtown Austin Community Court said in fiscal year 2018, 59 defendants were involved in about 1,500 cases. Court Administrator Peter Valdez says after they entered the court's intensive care management program, which offers assistance with housing and health programs,
collectively, they only had 7 cases. So I think that speaks to our ability to intensively assist individuals in finding stability from the medical, mental health, and substance use perspectives.
That's a 99% drop. Keep in mind, historically, a lot of the court's caseload involves offenses like sitting or lying down and camping in public. In 2014, it saw more than 16,000 of those cases, while in the past year, it's seen a little over 2,500. Part of that is attributable to the city's move to reduce that ticketing and associated fines because the lion's share of defendants can't pay them. Unpaid fines lead to arrest warrants, a near insurmountable barrier for people trying to get housing. Valdez says the court's case management program has helped 166 people get housing since 2016. Andrew Weber, KUT News.
The city of Austin is rethinking a program that places bad landlords under more scrutiny. KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports.
It's called the Repeat Offender Program. Basically, if a landlord gets a certain number of code violations over a period of time, that landlord goes on a list. Jeannie Luttrell lives in a North Austin apartment building.
We had a huge bed bug infestation, and we had almost 40 apartments infested. We had rats. We had mice. We're still fighting the roaches.
A report from the University of Texas Law Clinic in 2015 found that the repeat offender program was not being well enforced. So the city's code department is reevaluating it and asking tenants to give feedback. There's a meeting tonight at the Virginia L. Brown Recreation Center near Cameron Road and 183. The city hopes to have a report on the program by the end of January. Audrey McGlinchey, KUT News.
Just last month, the Austin Independent School District Board of Trustees voted to close 4 schools. This was the first step in a plan to close, consolidate, and expand programs across the district. But as the school board decides whether to close 8 more schools, KUT's Claire McInerney reports the discussion around those schools could have a greater focus on equity.
The reason equity could be important this time around is because of Stephanie Hawley.
So first of all, let me say good evening.
She's the district's new equity officer. And compared to her colleagues, who are often criticized for speaking in talking points and muddled communication, she's been speaking frankly about issues in AISD. Here she is speaking at the November 18th school board meeting.
The map that you have of the closures is a map of what 21st century racism looks like.
But she says her job is not to be what she calls the equity sheriff. She wants to make sure that every conversation with every person in every department is thinking about equity when decisions are made. Her biggest equity concern is how the district educates low-income students and students of color. Here's the reality in schools with a lot of poor kids. Schools have fewer resources, less experienced teachers, PTAs that can't raise hundreds of thousands of dollars to make up for what the district can't provide, and parents who often don't have the same time and resources to lobby for what their kids do need. To begin this conversation with AISD staff, she wrote an equity report that reviewed the initial closure plan and its rollout. That was released this month. While the report is critical, saying many aspects of that plan were inequitable, Holly says she doesn't view her job as trying to be combative with her new colleagues.
A lot of times people don't understand that shame and blame is not particularly useful, but you do have to tell the truth. You can either choose soft lies or hard truth. And when children are being harmed in educational systems, as an equity officer, I have to tell the hard truth.
And telling hard truths is the role of equity officers in many school districts across the country.
All right. Yeah, I was hearing some crazy feedback there for a second. Okay.
One example is the work Chris Chapman is doing in the Oakland Unified School District in Oakland, California.
And Oakland has not figured it out. We're just 10 years in.
Chapman has been doing equity work in Oakland for a decade. He started the African American Achievement Program, and now he's the Senior Advisor of Equity and Inclusion. And he says it can be a daunting job.
We are actually an outlier. The audacity of what we're being asked to do is pretty extraordinary, right? I mean, we're talking about really dismantling a mindset that's been fully baked for generations, both in the institution, the system and structure, and Black, white, brown, or otherwise, we've been trained and brought up in it.
And this is the kind of undoing Holly is beginning in AISD. She says she wants to do more training with staff and continue having hard conversations about how students are served. But she said she commends the superintendent for starting an equity department.
That takes courage, because that is an admission that what we're doing is not working. And that is the absolute first step in changing the culture. But there has to be patience and empathy for people as they come to grips with what it is we've been doing for a very long time.
Chapman says the education system in the U.S. wasn't designed to serve Black students, immigrant students, Asian and Latino students, because when we started public education, those students weren't in the classrooms with white children. So his role is to help leaders undo their idea of who school is for and how to teach every kid. Oakland is similar to Austin in many ways. Its student population is mostly kids of color. There's a high population of students from low-income homes. And because of declining enrollment, they are also closing schools. Unlike Holly, Chapman was in his role when this closure process began, and he was part of the strategy conversations. But similar to Holly, he had a differing view of how his school district should approach school closures.
So my strategy was take the problem to the people. Nothing about us without us, right? So meaning that we can solve our own problems. That the problem of school closures should not have a group of people, senior leadership, in a room coming up with, this is what we're going to do.
But that's not how Oakland approached it. Chapman says that's part of doing this job. He's worked under different superintendents and says this work can look different when new leaders come in because everyone's at different points. He says he has to be picky about what to fight for because he can't do it all at once, and he still wants some wins. And finding wins and seeing change happen is really important to Chapman, because otherwise, he says the job can become token. And it's happened to him when the Oakland School Board wouldn't adopt certain policies.
It just becomes window dressing and we have an office of equity. But when we really get to the action steps, the opportunity to really lean in and hold people accountable, the system stepped away.
This is the challenge Holly and the rest of AISD face as they get the new equity department up and running. This school year, Holly says one of the wins she'd like to see is for AISD to hire an outside group to do an equity audit of the district.
Until I know how deep the mud is, it's difficult to plan how to get out. We need a third party to come in and share with us what we're doing well so we can build upon it, and then help us disrupt that which is not serving our kids well.
And this audit could look at many things. Money, first and foremost. What are the decisions around schools that get money for programs, buildings, and support? Are low-income kids and special education students getting the support they need? Are schools with wealthy and involved parents getting more because they're persistent in asking? These kinds of things are examples of the 21st century racism Holly mentioned at that school board meeting. And she says Superintendent Cruz seems open to this kind of audit. Claire McInerney, KUT News.
Capital Metro is expanding its on-demand ride service pickup to Leander. KUT Samuel King reports city leaders there believe it's a step forward for transit service.
The expansion of the pickup service comes just months after city officials questioned Leander's relationship with CapMetro. Leander is a CapMetro member city and contributes more than $5 million in sales tax revenues to the agency each year. City spokesman Mike News says officials will see if the new pickup service helps drive ridership for other CapMetro services like Metro Express and Metro Rail.
Capital Metro will be giving us analytics and information to help us guide possible expansion of this service or any changes that may come about in the future. But certainly this is a step in the right direction, and we hope Leander residents take advantage of it.
The service allows people in certain zones to request rides through an app or by phone. Pickup is also available in Manor and parts of Austin. Samuel King, KUT News.
For a lot of people, the holiday season means trash and recycling bins that are at, near, or over capacity. During the season, you might find yourself standing in front of these bins with some byproduct of gift giving or feasting and asking yourself, what bin do I put this into? Well, never fear. KUT's Moz Bouchel is here, and he's got some answers.
One thing the city does not want in recycling bins are things like ropes and hoses that tangle up the gears that sort recyclables. Christmas tree lights will also do that and should not be recycled. You might also be aware that the city will mulch and compost Christmas trees, but not if they have that fake spray snow on them, says Austin Resource Recovery Director Ken Snipes.
That process interrupts the ability to compost those trees.
Other seasonal no-nos include tinsel, foil wrapping paper, and ribbons. None of that stuff goes into the recycling bin. If you have a gift that comes in a mix of cardboard and thin plastic packaging, like a kid's toy, separate the cardboard, recycle that, and then trash the thin plastic. Also, plastic shopping bags can't be recycled, and neither can styrofoam or electronics. Moz Bouchel, KUT News.
There is a small stretch at 37th Street just off Guadalupe with the Christmas light display that is anything but usual. If you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. Right now, if you go and see the lights, you're going to find a Baby Yoda. You're going to find a front yard volcano. You're going to see at least a few aliens, all adorned with Christmas lights. So we got a question about this holiday tradition for our AT Explained project from someone who wanted to know, who started hanging lights in the neighborhood? KUT's Jerry Quijano takes us to the 37th Street lights.
I already had plans to head over and see the lights on 37th Street this year. Then someone told me they wanted to come along and check it out. So off we went to explore the street pulsing with color and discover the origins of the lights.
Just say, like, my name is
Anna Quijano.
Wait, do it again.
Hi, my name is Anna Quijano, and we're at the 37th Street light show.
And how do you know me?
I am Jerry's mom.
She'd just driven up from San Antonio, and we're looking out as the darkest part of the night is beginning to be illuminated with glowing bulbs of electric color. There's blue, red, green, yellow, and everything in between.
The lights are connected between right over the street. I mean, over, it looks like it could be power lines, but they're just like roped from across the street from each other. Looks pretty cool.
She was probably thinking the same thing our question asker Liz Ortega thought when she used to visit the lights as a kid. Yeah, they look pretty and all, but is this safe?
You know, I went with my parents one year and my dad was an electrician and he was like, oh man, this is a fire hazard for sure.
Liz grew up in North Austin and visited the lights back in the early 90s. The festivities along the houses of 37th Street set a high bar for Liz's idea of Christmas. She just assumed everyone in Central Austin loved Christmas this much, but not in the usual Santa Claus, Frosty the Snowman, chestnuts roasting on an open fire kind of way.
It was like what made Austin weird. It was like one of those things. Like, oh yeah, that's why we call Austin weird, is because we have things like this around the town around Christmas, which almost had nothing to do with Christmas.
And so she wanted to know, who started this odd Christmas-adjacent celebration? Well, one of the people responsible for igniting the tradition is Jamie Lippman. He moved onto 37th Street in the late 1970s. He was stringing up his first set of lights when someone told him to try letting them hang straight down for a change.
I said, well, that's different. So I went with it. And a sort of a tic-tac-toe cross piece that I attached the lights to and then pulled it up with a rope. People could get in the middle of the strings and spin around.
Pretty soon, the other residents on the street started hanging their own lights. Then Jamie and another neighbor decided they wanted their houses to be connected by lights.
Across the road, over someone's house who had no lights, you know, just in the trees, and we connected. And that was sort of the big catalyst for people to, oh, I want to put up lights. I want to do this. So we ran with it.
Jamie says the 37th Street lights hit their heyday in the late 80s and early 90s, but as the light displays grew, so did concern that the whole thing might be a safety hazard. Then the blackout of 1993 happened. Jamie says he woke up one morning and walked out to find a city worker on a cherry picker removing the lights. So, as a form of protest, the residents on 37th Street banded together and shut down the whole thing. Then they told upset visitors that they'd have to take it up with then-Mayor Bruce Todd. So they did.
2 days later, they came back and put all the lights back up. And Mayor Todd walked down the street and said, we messed with Christmas. We made a mistake.
The lights burned bright until the mid-2000s when Jamie and some of his fellow neighbors moved out of the area. But thanks to the help of some new people on the block, the past few Christmases on 37th Street have been getting brighter and stranger. And that brings us back to this year. One of the first displays my mom and I bumped into was a science fair put on by stuffed animals.
Which stuffing type exhibits the greatest cuddling force? Do stuffed balloon animals withstand the weather better than traditional balloon animals? What should I put in my pouch? Says the kangy.
Does proximity to stuffed animals affect plant growth?
Charmin bears wear underwear, but not clothing. Why can't we see it?
So, not your typical light show so far.
Not at all.
Not all the houses on the streets are decked out in lights, but a good chunk of them are. People walk along both sidewalks, dipping in and out of yards, while cars drive down the road, moving almost as slowly as the fascinated pedestrians. And the displays, yeah, they're still a little weird.
Santa, what is he doing?
What does he say?
I can't see.
I think you have an idea.
Oh, he's pole dancing.
We walk down the streets, weaving through the people and houses, searching out the perfect spots for my now influencer mom to snap some photos.
I gotta document some of this on my phone.
Even though I'm doing a story on it?
Yeah, for my Instagram. Hello.
I remember coming here with my family as both a young kid, but then a lot also as a teenager. It was one of my favorite spots to go with many of my friends that lived around this neighborhood.
Robert Foster moved to 37th Street in 2015. He started rattling his neighbors to gauge their interest, and they decided to bring Glory back to 37th Street.
The first year it was very small, but there was just these two kids that were just having the absolute best time of their life right outside my window during the lights. And I just realized at that point that, like, we just had to do it. Like, we had to bring a little weird and a little joy back to Austin.
He says the lights on 37th Street embody the idea that Austinites are just a little different.
We come together. We also come together, and we don't want just to see Santa Claus and, like, a Christmas tree. We want to be creative. We want to be unique. We want to revel in, like, the diversity that the city has.
Some people say there isn't much weird left in Austin anymore. For me, yeah, the lights were weird and they were cool, but what did my mom think?
Would you say that this experience was weird?
Some of it was weird. Not a lot of it. A lot of it was just very creative to me. There's a few weird things, but I wouldn't call it. They need to get weirder.
Jerry Quijano, KUT News.
There's more on our AT Explained project at atexplained.org. And join us on January 23rd at the Hogg Auditorium for AT Explained Live. It is a night of live storytelling featuring eight never-before-heard AT Explained stories told in sound, images, and music. Details and tickets at events.kut.org. That is KUT Weekend for the fourth weekend of December 2019, and it is the last KUT Weekend of the year. Taking next week off, just a reminder. But I hope you'll join us again in 2020, and tell your friends to subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. Email any questions or comments to weekend@kut.org, or just tell me on Twitter. I'm at KUT Nathan. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org.